Welcome back to the BRI Podcast Network. You're listening to Hacker News Daily, and I'm Mia.
And I'm Milo. We've got a lively rundown today, kicking off with a fresh cybersecurity alert from CIUS about internet-exposed servers.
We'll also look at a proposal to retire outdated encryption handshakes, plus a deep dive into the Lean Proof Assistance soundness bug.
And coming up, a new way to think about model training, 10 advances in math and computer science from OpenAI, and plenty more from the Hacker News front page.
Stick around for all that and the rest of today's stories. Let's start with a security alert that CISAT issued on July 30th. The agency is warning that threat actors are increasingly targeting internet-exposed programmable logic controllers in the water and wastewater sector. These are the industrial control devices that keep treatment plants running. According to the census report covering the alert, attackers in some cases changed device passwords to lock out operators and even disconnected devices by altering their IP addresses. The consequences were real: boil water notices and sustained manual operations for affected utilities. CISAT specifically named Rockwell Automation, Allen Bradley, Siemens, and Schneider Electric Gear, and flagged cellular modems as a common blind spot in routine attack surface scans.
And what does the exposure picture actually look like out there? Census, working from a late July snapshot, counted roughly 4,100 Rockwell Allen Bradley hosts, a similar number for Siemens Simatic S7-1200 devices, and more than 2,000 Schneider Electric hosts. Now, Census is careful to stress this is purely an exposure characterization. It doesn't confirm any specific host was actually hit by the activity CSAA is describing.
That's an important distinction. The Hacker News discussion went deeper, with one commenter calling the situation gross incompetence and IT malpractice, and arguing CISAT and its predecessors have been warning utility operators about critical infrastructure vulnerabilities for roughly 15 years, going back to the first Obama administration. Yet here we are in 2026, and utilities are still leaving exposed systems online. CISAT's own guidance is straightforward. Remove publicly exposed PLCs and other operational technology from the internet entirely.
Okay. Next up, a standards development that quietly matters for anyone running TLS 1.2. A new IETF standards track RFC, number 10015, officially deprecates obsolete key exchange methods in TLS 1.2 and its datagram counterpart DTLS 1.2. It's authored by Anvi Araram and dated July 2026, updating a long list of earlier RFCs.
So what actually gets deprecated here? For TLS 1.2, the RFC is deprecating finite field Diffie-Hellman and RSA key exchanges, and discouraging static ECDH cipher suites. And it's an important scope note. This applies only to TLS 1.2 and DTLS 1.2. TLS 1.0 and 1.1 were already deprecated by an earlier RFC, and TLS 1.3 either doesn't use these algorithms or doesn't share the relevant configuration options. There's also no DTLS 1.1 to worry about.
Why does this matter for practical security? Non-ephemeral cipher suites basically lack forward secrecy, so a compromise today can decrypt past traffic. Reusing public keys can leak secrets through timing side channels. The raccoon attack on finite field Diffie-Hellman is the classic example. And invalid curve attacks exploit secret reuse in static ECDH. The group negotiation side is messy too. Some implementations only support small groups, custom groups are widespread, and clients can't practically verify them, and 1024-bit groups are uncomfortably close to current discrete log record territory. The RFC notes mitigations exist, but they're complex and implementations can fail at them.
Now for a story that kicked off a genuinely interesting debate about trust in formal verification. Leonardo de Mora posted a post-mortem about a soundness bug in the lean kernel, number 14576, reported and fixed during the last week of July. The trigger was a purported proof that had got around, a sorry, free disproof of the Colossus conjecture produced with AI assistance. It was invalid because it exploited a real bug in the kernel's handling of nested inductive types, one that let an ill-typed argument sneak through and make the kernel accept a proof of false.
The good news is the timeline was tight. On July 28th, Kiran Gopinathan reduced it to a small proof of false and opened the issue. A fix was pushed within an hour, reviewed by Joachim Breitner, merged, and patch releases went out. De Mora stresses this is an implementation bug, not a hole in Lean's underlying meta theory, and it's only reachable through metaprogramming. The front end catches the ill-typed term.
But the Hacker News thread went much deeper than the bug itself. One commenter concluded, "You can't trust code produced by N1000, even if it's a formal proof that passes the verifier." Another pushed back hard, arguing, "That's got nothing to do with LLMs. You can't trust any proof if you can't trust the verifier." A third made the sharpest point. Trust is necessarily conditional. The real advantage of a verified formal proof is that error is possible only if the verifier itself is faulty. Though, in practice, the proved statement might also mean something different than you intended.
Let's turn to a modeling idea that sparked real excitement and some spirited pushback. The Post, based on Alexei Gladstone's blog, argues that direct regression for generative modeling collapses to averages. Dog images become a brown blur, text collapses to the, so scalable models instead factor generation into small steps. The proposed approach, called explorative models, claims monotonic gains across image, video, and language. Big efficiency jumps in samples, parameters, and compute, plus matching diffusion on control tasks with dramatically less inference compute.
The reactions were telling. One commenter said that if the numbers hold at scale, every image model trained before this is now obsolete. Another called it important and simple to implement. But novelty was genuinely disputed. One commenter argued this is essentially DeepSeek's GRPO approach. Sample many generations, select the best of K, train on that sample, and similar to a technique called mini-batch optimal transport in flow matching, arguing prior work was neglected.
And the pushback on that had a technical edge. GRPO, as originally described, upweights samples that are better than average rather than only the best, and it doesn't involve an explicit likelihood. The paper does compare against mini-batch optimal transport in its appendix. That led the original commenter to concede the point about the original GRPO while still citing simplified best-of-K variants as prior work. Either way, the core idea, train models on their best guesses rather than averaged outputs, clearly struck a nerve.
Finally, a big one from OpenAI. In a publication dated August 1, 2026, the company says an internal version of Astra, its next major model, produced results on 10 problems that had been open with no progress on the main result for at least a decade, in most cases, much longer. The work spans high-dimensional geometry, coding theory, arithmetic circuit complexity, group theory, operator algebras, quantum complexity, lattice cryptography, and extremal combinatorics.
The economics here are striking. OpenAI says the total tokens needed to find these solutions would cost roughly $2,000 total at the current API rates. Humans prepared the arguments into manuscripts with the same model. The model formalized each argument in a lean certificate, and OpenAI is releasing each solution's narration of its thinking process.
And the results themselves are serious math. New upper bounds on sphere packing density down to the Cohn-Elkies threshold. Exponentially improved bounds on the maximum size of binary codes at any prescribed minimum distance, with analogous results for high-dimensional spherical codes. a construction establishing the existence of non-SOFAT groups. A disproof of Conness's rigidity conjecture. New lower bounds for computing the permanent with arithmetic circuits and formulas. This is category-defining work, and it builds on earlier threads. OpenAI notes a May AI-generated disproof of a conjecture discovered while evaluating an unreleased model, plus its initiative giving 100,000 scientists and mathematicians free access to its best ChatGPT models. If these results hold up under formal verification, this could be one of the defining milestones of the field. Let's start with a nasty bug in RipGrep, the fast file search tool. A developer on Hacker News posted a GitHub issue showing that the pre-built Linux binaries can occasionally crash with a segmentation fault during very large searches. The reporter hit the crash when searching a big directory tree at high concurrency, and it went down inside the memory allocator that ships with the statically linked Linux build.
So the interesting part is how they narrowed it down. The crash happened in a callot call triggered by reading directories, and it failed an internal integrity check in Muzzle's Malakong allocator. The reporter reproduced it with a script that generated roughly 20 gigabytes across 1.8 million files, then looped RipGrep over a string that wasn't there. On their 24-core system, it would usually segfault within about a minute once the tree fit in the kernel's block cache.
Worth mentioning that the same crash showed up in the RipGrep bundled with OpenAI Codex, and the reporter says that binary is byte for byte identical to the linked release one.
But a lot of the Hacker News arguing ended up being about the report itself rather than the bug. The reporter wrote up the investigation in a separate analysis repository, and commenters clashed over whether it reads like a decent write-up or like low-effort AI slop. Some found it unreadable and soulless, while others defended it, saying 1,000 written breakdowns of bugs can be far more detailed and concise than handwritten ones. Either way, the underlying crash is real and reproducible on a common setup.
Next up, Cursor users are upset about a change to the AI code editor's usage page. A forum thread surfaced on Hacker News titled, in all caps, "Usage page? To token amount? What?" Cursor switched the usage display from dollar amounts to token amounts, and users say that has made it much harder to figure out what they're actually spending day to day.
Users are complaining the change breaks budget tracking per user, per mammalian, and per repressed visibility and cost export. One team's admin cited a current billing cycle combined usage cost of $30,000, almost all of it at API pricing. Cursor staff confirmed the change shipped on July 31st. The usage page is now tokens only for self-serve plans, including teams, and they removed the spend metric, the cost column, and dollar costs from the usage CSV. Enterprise plans still show dollar amounts, and for individuals, there's no setting to switch back.
And the reasoning is explicitly a design choice. Token display is deliberate because included usage isn't billed, while on-demand usage beyond what's included still shows a dollar figure in the costs column. But the waters got muddy when a later reply said that CSV no longer contains dollar costs either. One user reports the API zeroed out per request cost fields, even for historical events and for build on demand usage, while period totals still exist.
The bigger debate underneath it is whether Cursor is still worth it in 2026. One paying customer since 2023 now uses Claude Code and Codex instead, and is asking what Cursor really offers anymore.
Now to a story from Canada that a legal scholar says went under the radar. In mid-July, Canada signed the United Nations Convention Against Cybercrime, and law professor Michael Reist is arguing this is much bigger than it looks. Ministers touted the treaty's child protection provisions and human rights safeguards, but Greist says the convention is really a sweeping cross-border surveillance and electronic evidence-sharing agreement, not primarily a cybercrime treaty at all.
The history here matters. The treaty started as a Russian initiative in 2017 designed to displace Europe's Budapest Convention. When the UN General Assembly voted to launch negotiations back in 2019, Canada joined the US and the EU in opposing the resolution, warning it was a vehicle for expanding state surveillance powers. In the end, the democracies chose to engage from within, and the authoritarian bloc's wish list of speech and content crimes was kept out of the final text when it was adopted by consensus in December 2024.
But Canada actually skipped the signing ceremony in Hanoi last October, along with the US, New Zealand, Japan, the Netherlands, Italy, Norway, Denmark, and Finland. Meanwhile, the signatories present included Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, Belarus, Cuba, Venezuela, and Saudi Arabia. Geist points out that leading human rights groups and 20 Canadian organizations and experts had urged the government to reject the convention, and key allies have so far declined to sign it.
So Canada signing this, months after skipping the ceremony, has human rights advocates asking, what changed?
Let's talk about NetBSD, the famously portable open-source operating system. Version 11.0 shipped on August 1st, and the release announcement from the project includes some practical advice for downloaders. The ISOM images have been split. There are compact under-700MB 400-ROM images and full-sized 995 images. If your 400-ROM size isn't a limitation, grab the 995 image, and if you're putting it on flash or USB media, use the MIG files instead of the ISA images.
The release had been delayed in part because the project waited for third-party components to make stable releases. And even though the release process has been streamlined and automated, it still needs manual steps, like the security officer signing the release hashes, and it's bottlenecked by the slowest part: transferring every file for every architecture over the network.
The project also addressed the elephant in the room, the open security issues. It says it can't publish a release without open issues, especially since the number of security problems found or suspected has massively increased with AI tools. So they chose to be transparent rather than delay further. The open items include a missing privilege check on the HD Auto device, with a manual workaround of removing the device node while audio still works, and fixes for null pointer and use after free issues in two firewall implementations, neither of which, the project notes, is included in any released kernel by default.
Thanks for simning and data slans. From simming about 2,000 Fitnights, this exactly witnessed space place is technical stage out chatted for a pickster. Thanks for simming me flowing, I were gonna choose for batter. And do you want it to charge the money bast form from exactly the 5,000 Alashin of EO catch? Thanks for the stigiway mentioned by click of the minitive and for which wades friendly. Thanks stands letting talkisting enter to get early. After, I look for these in here with small to expectable trandual minitus equal. Thinking for the stegeries, you can understand what they smell on your micro strong star. Think it's like being an expectly schedule strangible 4x for American and to your gathery. Thanks for what's back in my Alashin completion is the best one someone placing a bent for Fitagal de Vaver. Stead of my work Parsipal exact, because he's feeling disasting the street stark, so I have one more authority more than I respite this summer.
It's rolling out on Suman AI and Dalbao Pro, with API access promised soon via Byte Plus Model Arc. And to showcase it, the announcement includes a short creative film produced end-to-end by the model.
But the Hacker News reaction got philosophical pretty fast. One commenter asked whether these video models' only real use case is misinformation and spam, despite the whimsical demo clips. Others pushed back. Someone said they get genuine entertainment value and had heard of educators using the tools for higher quality explanations. Another said any director or storyteller can see potential for scenes that wouldn't otherwise be possible, while conceding there's plenty of slop out there. One commenter jokingly answered the question with a crude suggestion, and someone replied, that might unironically be more ethical.
A separate thread argued generative art models do more harm than good, unlike coding models. the reasoning being that code has to actually work so it can be treated as a black box, whereas delegating decision-making and thinking to a model feels harmful. It's a debate that's not going away anytime soon, and CDance 2.5 just gave everyone a fresh demo to argue over. The Victoria Metrics blog post, written by Jesus Espino and posted on July 31, 2026, offers a hands-on, runnable tour of what's new in Go 1.27, based directly on the official release notes and the Go source code. It's not meant to be exhaustive, and it actually continues an interactive tour series that Anton Zhurjanov wrote for Go 1.22 through 1.26. Zhurjanov decided to stop, so Victoria Metrics picked up where he left off.
So what's the headline change in 1.27?
Generic methods. For the first time, a method declaration can declare its own type parameters, independent of the ones on the receiver. Before 1.27, only top-level functions could be generic. There's one notable restriction, though. Interfaces still can't declare type-parameterized methods, and a generic method can't satisfy an interface.
And what else stands out from the tour?
A few things. Struct literal keys can now be any valid field selector, so you can set promoted fields from embedded structs directly. Generalized function type inference now applies everywhere a matching function type is expected, including conversions and composite literals, not just assignment. And there are compiler improvements. It now generates size-specialized memory allocation routines, which cuts the cost of some allocations under 80 bytes by up to 30%. Overall, you'd expect around a 1% gain in allocation-heavy programs at the price of roughly 60 kilobytes of extra binary size. And you can opt out with a specific environment variable, at least until 1.28 comes along. Finally, for modules that set Go 1.27 or later in their go.mod, tracebacks now include runtime profiler Gurian labels. Brander took a close look at PJTestDB, a Go and Postgres testing package built by Peter Downs that uses Postgres template databases, essentially cloning a prepared database, and benchmarked it against River's own schema-based test helpers. He had the Codex tool splice PJTestDB into River's test suite to see how they compare.
And how did the numbers shake out?
The PERSES timings were nearly identical. PGTestDB clones averaged around 98 milliseconds, while creating and migrating a fresh schema averaged about 99 milliseconds. But the overall wall time told a different story. The schema approach finished in about 14.5 seconds versus roughly 51 seconds for PGTestDB. That's about 3.5 times faster. The reason is that River pools and reuses schemas instead of creating a new one each time, and it leaves failed schemas behind for inspection.
So which did he keep?
Brander kept River on its existing method, but he plans to recommend PGTestDB in the docs for end-to-end tests, noting that reusing clones could bring it down to 10 to 20 milliseconds per test. In the comments, people debated ways to speed up template cloning. One suggested putting Postgres on a RAM disk. Another countered that turning off FSync is basically as fast without eating all your memory. And a third said disabling synchronous commit gets you most of the way there without corruption worries if something crashes midway. Peter Downs himself chimed in that TUPFS can work for debugging a few tests in a loop, but not if you sleep your computer and come back later. Solid 2 hit version 1.6.0, and the big addition is Fiber Workers, a new fiber execution mode built on top of the ASIC library. In the Hacker News discussion, someone asked whether multiple reactors can dispatch jobs with fibers, and whether multiple queues can use different strategies, say one tuned for I/O bound work and another for CPU bound work, since they'd had success running Sidekick on certain configurations, but didn't use those for main Rails apps.
And is that supported?
Yes, one commenter confirmed it is, crediting Carmine, who coded the update and covered it on his blog. The important caveat, fiber mode is not universally better. CPU-bound jobs gain nothing, and blocking libraries or C extensions that don't cooperate with Ruby's fiber scheduler will stall the reactor. The point, as someone put it in the PR discussion, is separately configured worker pools. So you can pick fibers where they help.
What does that look like in practice?
One commenter shared the production config their chat app runs. The chat and turbo queues use fibers, 10 fibers across a couple of processes, with different polling intervals, while notifications and other defaults use 5 fibers, and a dedicated CPU queue sticks with threads. On the mechanics, another commenter explained that fibers are data structures that save execution context, registers, instruction pointer, stack, and normally run on core pinned thread pools. They warned you can't blindly trust mutexes and semaphores because a fiber can change execution thread while yielding. And another put it simply, fibers move threading up into the application layer. MIT Sloan's research, reported by Betsy Varicky and led by finance professor Taha Chulkmane, set out to measure the quality of financial advice from large language models. The researchers had 1,000 adults write their own prompts for spending and investing advice, from GPT-5.2, GPT-5.6, or Gemini 3 Flash. Then simulated people aged 22 to 89 following that advice over time.
So, did the advice hold up?
Largely, yes. Following the AI recommendations produced sizable saving buffers for virtually everyone over age 30. The models consistently advised saving during working years, drawing down savings in retirement, investing heavily in diversified stock funds, and reducing stock exposure after 45. Where they fell short was adapting to shocks like unemployment. And they let portfolios drift rather than actively rebalancing.
Did more careful prompts make a difference?
Yes, more structured academic prompts. Asking for regulated professional advice, referencing life cycle planning and the user's best interests, and supplying full financial details plus economic assumptions, improved the advice quality. Though the AI still often generated too little active portfolio rebalancing. Chukmene noted that half of Americans say they use AI for financial advice, yet little is known about what advice they actually get or whether they act on it. The commenters zeroed in on that caveat. One joked that the missing half of that sentence, especially if you ask the right questions, is doing a lot of heavy lifting. Hacker News is digging into a NAS Compares piece updated July 22, 2026, arguing that over the past 18 to 24 months, the consumer and prosumer network-attached storage market has drifted away from modularity, local ownership, and hardware longevity, and toward cost-cutting, ecosystem lock-in, and restrictive design patterns stray out of the phone and walled garden world. The article lists 10 changes and goes deep on the first three.
Let's hear them.
First, soldered LPDDR RAM. Historically, that was limited to low-power ARM units, but it's now showing up on x86 entry to mid-range systems built around Intel's N100 and N150 chips. That ends memory upgrades entirely, and it caps memory-heavy Docker containers, ZFS pools, and virtual machines. Worse, a fixed memory module is a single point of failure. If the chip dies out of warranty, you're replacing the whole mainboard instead of swapping in a roughly $30 SATA. Second, many mid-range enclosures still ship with gigabit Ethernet. Even though 2.5 gigabit is now standard on mainstream motherboards, while faster 5 and 10 gigabit options sit behind big price premiums, with 10 gigabit used as artificial segmentation, even though cheap controller chips exist.
And the third?
Drive lock-in. most notably Synology's Enterprise and high-end Rack Station series, which restrict core features unless you install proprietary vendor-branded drives, producing persistent warnings, blocked storage pool creation, or disabled health monitoring. Public pushback brought only partial relief. Select 2025 and 2026 desktop models under DSM 7.3 can use third-party hard drives again, but the restrictions on third-party SSDs remain. The takeaway is that the market's longer-term selling points, upgradable hardware and open ownership, are quietly eroding, one model generation at a time. A team at Kyoto University has published new research on how habits actually form in the brain. Their study, out in Nature Communications, found that there are two separate neural pathways at play. One decides whether a behavior becomes a habit in the first place, and a second controls how intensely that habit gets executed.
That second part is interesting because it helps explain why different people can form the same habit but run with it so differently. The researchers bred mice and trained them with a two-stage method to build habits rapidly, then watched the transition happen in individual animals. They found that the connections from one brain region to another weaken as a behavior shifts into a habit, and that's what decides whether it sticks. A different circuit, feeding into a part of the striatum, is what sets how much the mouse actually carries the habit out.
So mice with strong responses in that second circuit kept executing the behavior at high levels, while weaker responses meant less execution. And the team could artificially step in on either pathway, nudging habit formation in one direction or changing execution levels with the other. Their point is that habit formation is more complicated than the old idea that repetition just mechanically copies an action. Even after a habit locks in, there are real individual differences in how often and how intensely it shows up.
The team wants to dig into what drives those differences next. Beyond understanding the science, they're hoping it could help people build beneficial habits and eventually support treatment for problematic ones linked to conditions like obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Stay on in the theme of habits, but for software teams now, there's an active debate on Hacker News around a piece by Endurata Wiraman titled, "The Prototype Isn't the Product." The central claim is that AI has dramatically sped up the march to a first working version, but it hasn't shortened the road between that prototype and something truly production grade.
The article frames the prototype as the thing that runs on your laptop, breaks under real load, skips error handling, might leak your API tokens, falls apart when a second user shows up, and leaves security as a nagging worry. The hard problems, the argument goes, were never about writing syntax. They're about judgment. What to build, how to structure it, what to defer, when to say no. And it claims models don't really have judgment, only pattern matching. The kind of failures that illustrates a generated query that triggers a full table scan on a table with 50 million rows, or a caching strategy that creates a race condition under concurrent traffic.
Now, the comment section is genuinely split on that core claim. Some readers agree, but push on the definition. One asks what even counts as production grade and suggests it's really a collective understanding of the system, not more complexity and excessive fault handling. Another says production grade typically means battle-tested by real users through complaints and feedback. AI can speed up iterating on that feedback, but the feedback loop itself is where most time goes, and no coding agent can speed that up. Their line, code was never the real bottleneck.
Others disagree a lot more bluntly. One reply just says, yes, it has shortened that distance. Another answers, nuh-uh. And one reader asks, what the heck this guy is smoking? So the conversation lands on a real, unresolved question. Whether AI changes the hardest mile between a demo and a dependable product, or just makes that mile easier to reach faster.
And that wraps up another packed week in tech and security. From CISA's warning about attackers going after internet-exposed servers, to RipGrep's new static binary build, ByteDance's CDance 2.5 video model, and NetBSD's 11.0 release, there was a lot to dig into.
We also explored why prototypes aren't the same as products, how habit-forming behavior works in the brain, and even the ways network-attached storage is getting less friendly for consumers.
Plenty to chew on. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.